thank you for coming. I'm going to talk fast, so please come and talk to me after the talk about anything that was a bit too fast. So this picture shows some test results that are happening in Mozilla's test automation. This is from a few years ago. The green letters represent test suites that passed on some set of tests, thousands of tests that passed on some platform. The orange markers represent tests that failed when these tests were run, and the red markers represent sort of catastrophic failure, like crashing. The interesting thing about this output here is that these are the results from a single change that basically changed a comment. So these test failures that occurred here are basically spurious failures. They are tests that are failing non-deterministically. So once in 100 runs, once in 1,000 runs, you know, some of these tests will fail. And when you run tests at a really large scale, when you're running millions of tests, every time you make a change, every time you run these tests, you're going to see some failures. And this is a real bummer. It means that there are bugs in the tests, maybe in your code, and it confuses the output of these systems. So we'd really like to be able to debug these failures, but it's very difficult to debug a test that only fails like once in 1,000 runs using traditional techniques. So this is a problem that we wanted to deal with at Mozilla. This non-deterministic test failure is a kind of interesting problem because the hardware developers have done a really good job of building deterministic abstractions on top of the crazy non-deterministic quantum world. But what we've done is that we've taken these deterministic abstractions and our software adds back in non-deterministic inputs that make the results non-deterministic. So we've got things like timing of events, input from sensors, from the network, from users. Those are changing all the time. They come into our systems and cause the outputs to vary. So an old idea is, what if we could record those non-deterministic inputs to our otherwise deterministic systems, store those inputs in some kind of log, and then later we could replay the execution with inputs being taken from the log instead of from the real world. If we did that and our system was truly deterministic, then we would get the same outputs. And if we could do that over and over again, we could debug these problems. This is a super old idea. This is the idea of record and replay of program executions. It's a very well-researched area. There's tons of systems in this area. This is only a subset on this slide. The thing is that most developers today still do not have access and do not use the tools that actually provide these capabilities. So at Mozilla, we thought, we really need these tools. They're not out there. Let's do a bit of research to try to build something that our developers could actually use and would want to use. So our basic goals were, we need to make it really easy to deploy. We need to minimize the barriers to entry. So we need to have stock hardware, needs to run on commodity operating system, no kernel changes, things like that. We wanted it to have as low overhead as possible, because high overhead tools create barriers to entry, at least perceived barriers. We wanted to make sure it worked on Firefox, because that's, of course, Mozilla's bread and butter. A tool that only worked on toy programs would not be useful. And we had to do this with a relatively small investment. We had maybe a few person years of time to invest in this project, and we needed to get something working in that time. So that really constrained our design choices to basically try to do simple things. So the basic idea is that we're going to have user space processes running into Linux, and we want to, if we can record all the inputs to those user space processes, then we can, if we can replay those inputs, then we'll be able to get the same process execution time after time. In particular, we'll be able to reproduce the exact memory and register states that the program went through, and then we can debug that. So the inputs to user space are basically the results of system calls and the timing and contents of asynchronously delivered signals. Those are the inputs we want to catch. One of the key design decisions we made early on was that we didn't want to do any code instrumentation. We wanted to just focus on, we wanted basically not, that's hard. It's high overhead and it makes things more fragile. So we're going to do as much as we can without instrumenting code. And we managed to get things to work by using a combination of hardware and operating system features that really only came into being and widespread and really in the last 5 years. So RR is kind of a timely project that the window of opportunity for this approach opened, and we took advantage of it, and hopefully it will stay open. I'm going to go through some of these features and talk about how we take existing operating system and hardware features and really repurpose them for this record and replay task. The most important thing we have to do is to capture the results of system calls. And for that, there's a Linux API called Unix API called ptrace. And ptrace lets you have a supervisor process supervising a thread or another process, and you can get tracks before and after each system call. And in particular, after each system call, the supervisor process can look at the state of the tracee and record the results of system calls to some log. That's fairly straightforward stuff. One of the key sources of non-determinism in modern systems is data races. So if you have multiple CPUs and running at the same time, one CPU writes to memory, another CPU reads, you don't know whether the read occurred before or after the write in general, so you don't know which value it's going to get. And that can vary basically non-deterministically depending on clocks and things. So this is a really hard problem. There's a lot of research on how to solve this. Most of it is very complicated or slow or both. So we basically punted on the problem and said, we're just going to address mostly single-threaded at a time workloads. So web browsers are highly have lots of threads, but they don't tend to use that much parallelism when you're running test workloads. So we're going to shove everything onto a single core, and we're going to manage context switching, and we can record the timing of context switches, and that will give us deterministic threading. A key problem for these systems is handling asynchronous events. So if the program, for example, does an alarm system call and then later on gets a signal interruption, we want to make sure that signal runs at the right program state during replay, at the same program state where it was recorded. The basic idea is we need to have the application make exactly the same amount of progress during replay as it made during recording. So the ideal thing to do would be to count the number of instructions executed and deliver the signal after exactly the same number of instructions have executed. And there are hardware performance counters that can purport to measure that, and so that's what we try to use. Unfortunately, there is jitter in the measurement that the hardware gives you. I'm not going to go into exactly why that is, but at least on Intel, this is not a reliable counter, so we can't use it. What is reliable is if you count on Intel, modern Intel hardware, if you count the number of retired conditional branches, that is a reliable measure, and it's a good enough measure of progress for our purposes, and so we use that. There are a number of other gotchas to do with using these counters in things like virtualization and so on, which I could talk about offline if people are curious. The neat thing about this is you're doing it in hardware, there's a zero overhead, no code instrumentation. Another really interesting problem is we want to get as high performance as possible. I mean, we implemented all the stuff I just talked about, and performance was still not very good. And the reason why is kind of obvious if you look at this slide. So when you're using ptrace to intercept system calls, you have to do these two traps, and so there are four context switches shown in this diagram. Each of those context switches on Linux is much more expensive than your average read call. And so this makes these system calls really expensive, and that is a huge problem. So what we do is we introduce a shim library that gets loaded into the process we're tracing. It's part of the recording and the replay. And this shim library wraps these common system calls and has code after the system call essentially to record the results into a buffer. And that buffer is periodically flushed by the supervisor process. So this way we can record the results of system calls without doing any context switches. So that's good. There are a couple of interesting problems here. One is that this read system call in the library has to not trigger those ptrace traps that we were trying to avoid. And so we need a way to selectively generate these traps. And fortunately, one of those was added by Google some time ago. Google created this SecComp BPF sandboxing approach. So the idea is that you have a way to inject these BPF predicates into the kernel, these bytecode predicates that the kernel can compile and run very fast. They run in the kernel, and they can decide whether or not to allow certain system calls to occur. And if you want to block a system call, you can generate a ptrace trap or generate some other kind of action. And so we retarget this. This was originally for sandboxing. We retarget it here for our own purposes. Another key issue with these this approach is, what happens if one of these system call blocks? As I mentioned earlier, RR controls the scheduling of threads running on the single core. But if a system call blocks, RR needs to be notified about that, and then it needs to be able to schedule a different thread to run. So we need to know when a thread blocks in the kernel. Well, There is actually a way to do that now. It's that basically Linux has these deschedule software performance events that you can get notifications about. So one of these events fires every time a thread is moved off of a core and basically put on some idle queue, which is what happens when a process blocks. So when this happens, our supervisor process gets this performance event, and it can use that as a queue to run a different thread. So again, we're retargeting these performance events for sort of interesting purposes. But that all works really well. Now, I sort of lied to you earlier on about CPUs being deterministic. They actually have various non-deterministic features that we have to handle. So I'm just going to briefly sketch some of that. So obviously, reading the timestamp counter from the CPU is fairly non-deterministic because it's a cycle counter. Fortunately, the Intel hardware has a way to generate traps every time that instruction executes in a user space process. And so we use that to generate these traps and record and basically trap and emulate these instructions. Obviously, the RDRAND instruction should not be deterministic. And that is a problem for us, but fortunately, it's hardly ever gets used by user space. These transactional memory extensions that Intel has are also non-deterministic from our point of view, because things like hardware interrupts or cache state, which are invisible to user space, can cause basically spurious failures of transactions. And so that creates problems for our tool. Fortunately, a lot of these problems are mitigated if we can trap and emulate a CPU ID instruction. And so we can actually do that in modern hardware. Modern Intel hardware can trap and emulate CPU IDs from user space. We've just added an API to the Linux kernel, which has gone upstream, and it's in 4.12, that will let you user space programs trap and emulate CPU ID in other user space programs. So we're using that. But also, if you don't have that kernel, we can basically have patches and hacks to work around that. Let's look a little bit at performance. So this is probably the key performance slide. These workloads, CP is a recursive file copy benchmark. Octane is the JavaScript browser benchmark. HTML test is Firefox running some sort of HTML unit tests. And Samba test is the Samba file and directory server running some tests. So as you can see, the recording overhead for these workloads, which most of which represent, by the way, real-world things people use RR for, these workloads are all less than 2x recording slowdown, which is good. The replay is actually faster than the recording, which is also good. And that's because we don't actually have to execute many system calls. All we have to do is get the results of system calls out of the log, and that's pretty much always faster than actually doing the system call. So that's good. And one thing I've shown here, the baseline for these results is a full, like, it was my 4-core laptop, right, running the whole benchmark using all available cores. So part of the overhead, the overheads here include the overhead of restricting to a single core. And I've shown that overhead on this graph. So you can see that most of these workloads are pretty single-threaded, except for Octane, which does have some parallelism. But we still do OK. So performance is pretty reasonable and very usable. On top of the record and replay engine, which I've talked about, we also provide some debugging capabilities. And the debugger, in particular with record and replay, on top of record and replay, you can implement sort of a simulation or reverse execution. I haven't got time to talk about how that works, but I can talk about it offline if people are interested. Reverse execution debugging is superb because debugging is about tracing effects back to causes. And so you actually want to be working backwards in time, whether you're aware of it or not. And people who you can see from this tweet here, this guy's at Google, you can see that a lot of people who use RR are actually really excited about it. And so I think we've been successful in terms of building a tool that people like to use. So let me talk a bit about some lessons that we learned through this project and actually getting it deployed in the real world. So one important lesson is that for a tool like a debugger, replay performance really matters. Once you've captured a test failure, the reverse execution system and even just normal debugging are going to have to probably replay that execution many times, and that means that performance during that is important. Also, your programmer is sitting there waiting for results while you're doing that replay. So replay performance is really important for these systems, and sometimes it gets overlooked in research. Another issue is that when you're doing, for many of the applications of record and replay, like reverse execution, part of how that works is periodically we have to take checkpoints of the current system state. And though the performance of that, the sort of time and space performance of those checkpoints, creating them and then restarting them, that is really important to perceive performance. And so your design decisions can actually really impact that. So a lot of, some previous systems doing record and replay worked on the whole virtual machine. And that's nice for many reasons, but it does mean but checkpointing the state of the virtual machine is going to be more expensive than checkpointing the state of a few processes, especially when we have a, like the fork system call that does very nice copy and write optimizations. So session cloning performance does matter. A sort of a negative lesson we learned from this is that, you know, to get our performance, to meet our performance targets, we had to do that in-process system call stuff with that shim library. And that works, and it's essential for our performance at this stage, but it is kind of an unfortunate way to have to do things. We've found all kinds of fragility in that approach. Applications can break our library, for example, by creating threads with invalid thread local storage setups. You know, applications basically, complicated applications like web browsers and do weird things, and it's easy for them to break your shim library in different ways, in Linux anyway. And also, if you're working with malicious code, having code that you depend on being the same address space as the malicious code is inherently vulnerable. So this is an area where we might want to try to move some stuff into the kernel if we decided to relax our constraint and actually make kernel make bigger kernel modifications. There's interesting implications here for OS design as well. So when you're building a record and replay system, you want the boundary where you're recording your inputs to be as simple and stable and as well documented as possible, because you're going to have to essentially instrument that whole boundary and make sure that you collect all the inputs coming across. It's also, for our approach of using hardware counters to measure application progress, you also want that boundary to be a natural boundary where you can measure the performance counts that happen within that boundary, right? We need to measure the events that happen within the boundary and not outside the boundary. So the Linux kernel user boundary is great because, I mean, it's not that simple, but other than that, it basically has all these properties. But if you look at, say, a system like Windows, the stable and documented API boundary is not the kernel user boundary, it's actually higher level. It's the kind of this DLL API that gets exposed on top of the kernel. And so for doing the RR approach in Windows will be much harder, certainly for a third party like us. Microsoft could do it because they have knowledge of the kernel, but otherwise it's very difficult. One other interesting design constraint that came up was that our approach doesn't work on ARM. And it's for interesting reasons. So ARM uses this load link store conditional approach to atomics. And so the basic idea is that you load something from memory, you do an operation, and then you store it back. And that store can fail. And unfortunately, that store can fail non-deterministically because of things like a hardware interrupt occurring at a bad time. And again, this is invisible to our tool, so sometimes you're taking extra trips around the loop, and we don't really know why, and running the program, running the same instructions again, you might get different results. And so this creates problems for us that we have not, that we basically need either hardware support or we need to go back and actually bite the bullet and do binary instrumentation. Related work, so most of the systems basically compared to our existing systems are either higher overhead or they rely on kernel changes or maybe they have more limited scope. They might say, we're not going to handle programs that have data races, for example. So a lot of systems do that. So RR is kind of the spot in between all those. So quickly, the conclusions. We built something that delivers a lot of value to users. I think there's a lot of interesting research that can and should be done to improve the multi-core situation. I think there's actually hope there, even for a software approach. I can talk about that with people who are interested. Also, there are lots of unexplored applications. Once you have the engine that can do this recording and replaying, you conceptually have access to all program states, right? Reproducing any program state is a matter of computation, and computation is relatively cheap. So we can build all kinds of interesting things, and happy to talk about that offline with people. Anyway, RR is an open source project. If you use GDB for user space stuff, and you want a better experience, you should try it out. Pretty much most people who try out RR actually get a really good experience and start using it a lot. That's the end.
Thank you for your talk. So as you mentioned that R enforces one thread one time to record the non-determinism. So my question is that, do you think that will cause the disappearance of some
bugs? Yeah, that's an excellent question. And the answer is it can do. But we have some techniques to mitigate that. So one of Aura has this feature called chaos mode, where we basically randomize the scheduling using, and it's not just purely, you know, this actually is quite sophisticated heuristics to make it easy to reproduce bugs. I'm happy to talk more about that offline, how those heuristics work. But we can actually do some predictioning things to make bugs reproducible.
Yep.
Hi, I've been working on multi-version execution, which is very related. And what about virtual system calls?
VDSOs. Yeah. So virtual system calls. We patch the VDSO to make normal system calls, and that adds a bit of overhead, but not much really in the big scheme of things.
Okay. And what if the application has undefined behavior, like reading from uninitialized memory?
That's totally fine, because we're reproducing the exact memory and register states of the process. If you read uninitialized memory during recording, we will reproduce the exact read during replay.
Okay.
Because we're not logging the internals of what memory,
Okay, thanks.
Cool.
And Nadav Amit, VMware. How do you deal, for instance, with mDevice-free that can...
I couldn't really hear that.
How can you deal with mDevice-free that affects how memory is, which memory is reclaimed later on by the operating system at undefined time in the future?
Sorry, is it mAdvise or?
mAdvise-free, which affects how memory is reclaimed later on.
So yeah, there's a couple of non-deterministic mAdvise options. So when we're recording, we convert those into sort of deterministic equivalents. So like if it's, I can talk about that offline, but.
Thanks, and ASLR as well?
I can't.
Address space, the layout randomization, do you deal with it?
Address space, ASLR is not a problem because during recording, we basically record the locations of all memory maps, including those placed by ASLR. And then during replay, we use map fixed to ensure that all those maps are recreated in exactly the right locations.
Thanks.
Yep.
Kamala, UC Santa Cruz. Have you looked at applications that have randomization, maybe back off mechanisms? And have you,
kind of randomization?
Like back off mechanisms, exponential back off, something like that.
I mean, so if an application does sort of random stuff internally, it's getting its random numbers from some source, right? So basically, we're going to record and replay the operation of the random number generator. And so we're going to get the same random numbers out at the end. I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yep.
Hi. So first of all, one of my colleagues wanted to say that you saved him about a month of work over the last year.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Hey.
But the thing that I wanted to ask was, one thing that I've noticed is it's very hard to move traces on R between different machines.
That's right.
Could you say a little bit about why that's difficult?
Right. There's a couple of issues. One is simply the trace format. So RR does a bunch of optimizations where if there are files that aren't changing or shouldn't change, we don't copy them into the trace file to save, just basically to speed things up. So we have a new RR pack command that undoes that. So basically gathers all the files from your system that are relevant to the trace and moves them into the trace. So that helps. Another issue is that CPU ID is an issue. And so we're fixing that right now. Yeah, I'll talk about that offline.
Thanks.
Good. Time to go. Good. Thank you.